Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 28th, 1998. In the Creekside room this morning is Paul Contino. Session number is 98-2 and is titled Icons and Prayer. Let's listen in.
As I said yesterday, when we talked about the tension in Simone Bay, one thing I was going to try to do with these presentations, hi Dorothy, was to link them a little bit with the Bible study in the morning and with practicing our faith, so that the reading you're doing, the conversations you're in, you could be making connections between them and what we talk about here. What I'd like to do is to begin then with an image of Moses. Many of you may have been in Bible study this morning. The story was from Exodus and God's directive to Moses concerning the food for the people of Israel after they left Egypt. And I want to begin with this 13th century icon to begin by framing a question that's been a very real one, especially in certain periods of Christianity. That is the place of images in our prayer life, both personally and communally. And so, from the monastery of St. Catherine in Sinai, this is an image of Moses. And do you recognize the scene? Burning bush, right? He's taking his sandals off because this is holy ground, right? And I'm going to read to you the passage from Exodus 3 that this icon represents. It's a theophany, right? It's a presentation of God, the first for Moses. And one of the concluding images we will see of Elijah will also be a theophany, God revealing God's self. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire, out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight, and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, and he said, Here I am. Then he said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And that's the issue here. How do we look at God? God says, No person shall see my face. We talked yesterday about attention toward the other person, what we do when we look at someone who's in affliction. We look with a countenance that's open, a smile, leaning forward, perhaps with open hands. Not like Eli toward Hannah, you're drunk. Not accusatory, but open. But what about looking at God? Here Moses hides his eyes. In the Orthodox tradition, looking is so important. In our Western tradition, take up and read works that Augustine hears in his moment of conversion is very important to us. And of course for Orthodoxy too. There is the image of Christ, the Logos, holding the Word. But look up and see is also an important theme in Orthodoxy. And by the end of this presentation, I'm hoping that we can talk a little bit about ways in which we've looked up and seen. But secondly, the way our seeing doesn't turn into idolatry. Because if we turn to Exodus 20, right, the second commandment for many Christians, Paul is telling me that in the Lutheran Ten Commandments and in my own tradition, the Catholic tradition, this doesn't become the second commandment. But here, in Exodus 20, when the commands are given. Thou shalt make no graven image, no idol of anything in heaven. All right, you will recall that. And so, when Calvin reads this, for example, and I'll just read you a little bit from Calvin's Institutes, this means that an image like this would be forbidden. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Calvin College, and I had a very good friend, a number of good friends there. And if you go into the Calvin College chapel, you will not see any images at all. Here at Holden, we have the image of the crucifix. But for Calvin, to present an image of God is to disobey Exodus 24, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. And here's Calvin himself. The majesty of God is defiled by an absurd and indecorous fiction when he who is incorporeal is assimilated to corporeal matter. He who is invisible to a visible image, he who is a spirit to an inanimate object, and he who fills all space to a bit of paltry wood or stone or gold. Yesterday, Dorothy Miller was talking about the grandeur of God not being limited, right? And Calvin's concerned about this. God is transcendent. He can't be closed in. And so, how do the people who defend the icons, the holy images, for an orthodoxy, the image is central. It's just central to the spiritual life of the believer and to the sacramental life of the church. How do they get around this? And Jennifer and I were talking yesterday about discernment. And one way of putting this is, how do we discern when we look at an image, a holy image, that it's not becoming idolatrous, that it's an icon, that it's not falling into a kind of, Calvin will speak of a kind of lust of the eyes, where the corruption of the will creates an idol out of any image. How do we discern when that might be happening? How do we discern when this is a genuine event of prayer? What I wanted to do first was talk a little bit about some origins of the icons. Where do they come from? And I'll begin with this image. You can kind of see, it's from a place called Fayum, Egypt. And it is a mask that would go over the mummy of a dead person. And you can see it's fairly realistic in some ways, but also kind of stylized. The eyes are perhaps bigger. Most of the Fayums that you see in museums look very much like this. It was placed on the mummy so that the ka, the spirit, could recognize the person and return to the mummy. So around 5th, 6th century, when icons like this are being painted, you can see that some of the techniques of Fayum painting show up here. For one thing, encaustic. I think in your handout you see a definition of encaustic, and this icon of Christ, very famous one, some of you may have seen it before, is made in this way. A method of painting, this is down below in the timeline and glossary. A method of painting with colored molten wax, in which the wax is fused with the surface by the application of heat. The difference is, it's not painted by just anyone. It's now painted by people in monasteries. Okay? And this is one, again, from the monastery of St. Catherine in Sinai. And I wanted to pause on this one for just a minute, because it is one of my favorites, and I'm wondering how you respond to it. Yesterday we read a poem in which Christ appears as one who feeds the speaker in the poem in Love 3, and is an attendant, lovingly serving him. What kind of image of Christ do you see here in this icon? What adjectives would you use to describe Christ's image here?
I'm drawn to the eyes.
Yes.
And that one eye is sort of different from the other one, and
yes.
It's human, I guess.
It's
human,
it's human. It's
not,
imperfection.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I guess that's sort of looking at you. I don't know. That's kind of my first impression.
Okay, so the emphasis upon the humanity of Christ, okay? Yes,
to me it looks incredibly powerful as at the same time that he's very vulnerable. Mm. It's an amazing paradox, both of those things at the same time.
Where would you locate the vulnerability? I mean, you have to point to one part of the painting.
Probably a combination of the eyes and the mouth.
Yeah.
But something even about the neck.
It's exposed.
Yeah.
It's fleshy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what about the power? Where do you see the power?
Also in the eyes.
Yeah. Sometimes what my students will do is they'll say, if you look at these specific perfect face, one eye different from the other, this eye has a kind of vulnerability, a kind of openness, an invitation. Whereas this eye, well, maybe this isn't the eye you'd want to be greeted with. There's a power here. This is Christ Pontifier. This is Christ Lord of the universe. But it's also God become man, God descending to our human condition. And it somehow, I think as Roberta is saying, paradoxically captures both the particularity of personhood, this is Christ at a certain time, a certain place, and timelessness. This is a very powerful Christ, Lord of the universe, who blesses, who holds the Word in his hand. He is the Logos, who was with God in the beginning, in creation.
I see a real penetrating gaze,
yes.
that can see all, it
yes.
seems to me. See into the depths of your soul.
Yeah. I think that's very important. That frontal gaze in which the eyes look into yours is very important in the Orthodox experience of prayer. There's an I-thou kind of experience. I'm using the language of Martin Buber, who Dorte Zola was speaking of yesterday. We were talking yesterday about a sense of presence in a poem that we respect. And there's a kind of presence here, you might say, that's penetrating us and knows us. Yes?
I see another paradox.
Yes.
I see him as a teacher, but as also one that's asking a question. Like he's listening very carefully.
Yeah.
Have you a question?
For some reason, I really see a lot of sadness. It just looks so sad. It's like, oh man, this is... I don't see anything happy.
Does anyone see anything joyful or potentially joyful, mm-hmm. or all sadness?
No, it's just...
I see serious and almost unfriendly.
Unfriendly, okay. Are you looking especially at the right side of the picture?
Well, I don't know. Is that the whole...
The whole countenance suggests that.
Well, and the darkness of it, too, can suggest kind of, I suppose, unfriendliness.
Yes,
I'm wondering if, I'm speaking as a historian now.
Yes.
All the monastic sayings, early monastic sayings, about the dangers of laughter.
What's what?
They talk a lot about the dangers of laughter.
Yes, yes, yes. It's
and
so
I'm
interesting.
I'm wondering if this isn't a cultural thing. You know,
yeah.
We assume that if you're friendly, you smile.
Yes.
But there are lots of cultures, even now, where a smile is, unless you're in an intimate relationship, is not necessarily.
No, it's very, very interesting. I've been working on editing an essay.
Interesting.
Laughter. When we laugh, when do we laugh? Think about it.
When we're happy.
When we're happy.
When
we're nervous sometimes.
It's
when we're what?
Embarrassed.
Embarrassed, right?
When we're making fun of somebody.
We're making fun. Laughter can be cruel. Laughter is a joyful thing. At Matins yesterday, we heard a poem about laughter and a kind of laughing God. There's a way of understanding laughter, too, as being a kind of release from passions, anxiety, nervous. Laughter, it's a liberation. I mean, it's a wonderful thing, and then you feel calmer afterwards. Did Jesus ever laugh? Was a question that some of these early Christian thinkers asked. Some would say, no, he wouldn't laugh because he didn't have those passions. He was human. in all things but sin, and the passions maybe that Roberto was talking about last week were not ones he needed to release, so there wouldn't be that. I have all that said, I have to say, I love this icon, and I can't help but to me see something like the hint of a smile as well as some of what you were saying, the sadness. And a smile I guess I would see is different from laughter, an openness, a welcoming.
I see world weariness.
World weariness too?
Yeah.
Dorothy?
Well, it's just very suggestible, because when someone said it looks sad, I thought, oh yes, it looks sad. But then you say you see a hint of a smile, and now I see the hint of a smile.
Yeah.
And so either I'm very fickle, or it's very,
it is an amazing painting. Yes, no, yeah, it's just, yeah.
I was going to say, I think part of that is, you know, we're all the comments so far have been on the face and the head, but
yes.
To me it's the hand. It's the hand is upraised, the hand is like in motion. The hand is open, and I think that's the part that there is the potential of movement, the potential of something else. Like where you're talking about the potential of a smile, I think that whole hand to me is what I keep seeing as the life in it.
I love that. And the potential. I mean, there's a sense of plenitude kind of in this painting. The word potential kind of gets at, and paradox gets at, that encompasses so much. It's in the Monastery of St. Catherine. I believe it's one of the earliest icons we have, 500 or so. Yes?
I have two questions. What is the significance of the position of the fingers? Because I noticed that in yesterday, too, with the two together and the two bottom together, that's not a very natural pose for most people with their fingers, but it seems to be done in religious painting.
A few weeks ago, I visited an Orthodox church with my students. And a priest said that it was an influence of the East, possibly. When you see the Buddha, sometimes there is a similar motion. I haven't explored this, and I'm very interested in learning more about this gesture. Roberta?
What the Orthodox say is that the three fingers on the bottom, the thumb of your finger, stands for the Trinity, and the two fingers on top stand for the divinity and humanity.
Divinity and humanity of Christ.
So it's a kind of statement of, it's a kind of shorthand
theological
creed. Priest always blesses that way.
It's used in liturgy, priests, the way they use their hands.
Yeah.
And maybe just to bring this part of the conversation to a close to move on to the other, would that be okay? Okay. Because the thing is, why would an Orthodox believer need an icon like this? One might say that visually it represents one of the councils. If you look at that timeline, okay, you've got between 325 and 681 succeeding councils defining church teachings, especially the mysteries of the Trinity and the Incarnation. In 451, the Council of Chalcedon affirms Christ is perfect in divinity and humanity. And somehow all the things we're saying about the sadness, the hint of the smile, the power, the open hand, the logos, all of these suggest both humanity and divinity, paradoxically united in Christ, which Chalcedon is formulating, and others in the church are talking about and teaching. Let me just move on to show you a couple of images of even earlier. I'm sorry I don't have a better one. This is an illustration of the kind of image you might see, in one of the catacombs, the image of the Good Shepherd. Here Jesus doesn't have a beard, and there's an influence here too. Roman sculpture. This is a statue, a Roman statue from, I think it's 2nd century, and it's it's a representative of a kind of philanthropic generosity in Roman times. Well, the Christian imagination links this to John's Gospel, I am the Good Shepherd, and uses this image. Another catacomb image, and again, kind of going back to one of the councils here, Ephesus, you see that Mary is holding Christ, she's flanked by two saints, and there's a woman on the left, on our left, whose hand, whose shoulder is being touched by the hand of the saint behind her. This is a votive image made on behalf of a woman who has died, the woman dressed in black, flanked by saints in memory of her, asking for the intercession of the saints. And the Council of Ephesus declared that Mary was the Theotokos, the God-bearer. And so you have more and more images like this after that council, where Mary is holding Christ in this central place. And we'll see more of these soon. I wanted to just give you a couple of dates here. In 330, Constantinople was inaugurated as the imperial capital, right, after Christianity was officially tolerated. About 500 years after that, in 537, Emperor Justinian erected Holy Wisdom, Hagia Sophia, in Constantinople, a very important place for the Orthodox believer. The image of Sophia, which is sometimes linked with the Logos in the beginning of John's Gospel, Holy Wisdom, has a very important place in Orthodox theology. And when we go to the interior of Hagia Sophia, you can also see the minarets, because in 1453, Constantinople was overtaken by the Turks, and it became, for a long time, a mosque, and now is kind of a museum. But people that go there, and I haven't been there myself, maybe some of you have, speak about the quality of the life in this place. And the dome, of course, if any of you have been in an Orthodox church, you know that almost always they're domed, suggesting, I think, a sense of God's imminence. This is the way it's been described to me, closeness, as opposed to, say, a Gothic vault where there's a kind of yearning toward transcendence. And this was very influential in Russia, the same kind of architecture, the dome. You can barely see an icon in the back. This is a church in Kiev. And for a long time in the West, this is a church in Sicily. And you can barely make out there an icon of Christ Pantocrator there in the dome. And also one in, this is a very famous one in Venice, San Marco. This is the monastery of St. Catherine's, also founded by Justinian, a place I would dearly love to visit someday, along with Hagia Sophia, where this image of the Transfiguration, again, a quite early image, is present. And here I just wanted to say a few words about the significance of this image. One of the ways that the Orthodox imagination understands the incarnation is that God became human so that we human beings could become God. The icon points to the transfigured flesh, where our passions are transfigured, where our humanity is seen the way it ought to be. There is an acknowledgement of the fall in the Orthodoxy. We did in Adam and Eve sin. There is such a thing as original sin. But with the sacraments, with the incarnation, we somehow begin to take on the image and likeness of God that we were called to be. And in a process called deification, become God. Become what we're called to be, that is made in the image and likeness of God, which has become tarnished and flawed because of our sin. That's one of the ways in which the Orthodox imagination understands what we see in the icon, the transfigured flesh, what we're called to be. When, in the 8th century, icons were under attack, in part for political reasons, the emperor, gaining power, saw this as a way of getting power over the monks and others. John of Damascus, who's one of the great teachers of the Orthodox tradition, the Christian tradition, generally wrote a defense of icons. And the linchpin of his argument is that why can we use matter, wood, paint, wax, to image God? Because, he writes, God became matter. God became flesh. And in doing so, matter is given a new kind of, it is worthy now of a new kind of veneration. Let me use John's words. He writes, in former times, he's directing his comments to those who would point to Exodus, right? Thou shalt make no graven image. In former times, God, who is without form or body, could never be depicted. But now when God is seen in the flesh, conversing with men, I make an image of the God whom I see. I do not worship matter. I worship the creator of matter, who became matter for my sake, who willed to take his abode in matter, who worked out my salvation through matter. Never will I cease honoring the matter which wrought my salvation. I honor it, but not as God. I salute all remaining matter with reverence, because God has filled it with his grace and power. Through it, my salvation has come to me. This emphasis upon the incarnation as that which transforms the quality of matter is a very important part of the Orthodox defense of imaging God in material form. Maybe I'll just sit here. I can just move these slides around like the cheese slides. These are two saints that are very famous in the Russian tradition, Boris and Gleb. They were killed for political reasons. They kind of gave themselves up to martyrdom. And I show their images because in becoming martyrs, they somehow conform to the image of Christ, who gives his life. One thing that's emphasized in these two saints is this notion of kenosis, self-emptying. In 2 Philippians, St. Paul says that Christ emptied himself to take on our human form and to accept death on the cross. These human beings are imitating Christ in that act of kenosis on their part, giving up their lives. And I say all of this because in John of Damascus' imagination, and in part of his defense of the icons, it leads to a veneration of the particular. That is, particular people are closer to God by virtue of their conformity to God's will. Here with Boris and Gleb, the conformity that takes the form of martyrdom. And this does differ perhaps a bit from some of the things we were talking about last night. If those of you who were in George Tensola's session on mysticism, where there was an emphasis on a kind of a quality of mysticism. And I think that's a very important point, that we are all called to be mystics, to be uniting our will with God's. In John's defense of the icons, though, he would say that there are people who get closer to this than others. And he uses, I think, a striking image, fire and iron. He says, first of all, there are those places where God, who alone is holy, has rested. In a sense, we saw an image of one in the beginning, Moreh, where Christ, where God appears in the burning bush. He rests in holy places, that is, the Theotokos, Mary, and all the saints. These are they who have become likenesses of God as far as is possible, since they have chosen to cooperate with divine election. Therefore, God dwells in them. They are truly called gods, not by nature, but by adoption, just as a red-hot iron is called fiery, not by its nature, but because it participates in the action of the fire. Okay? So the closer the iron gets to the fire, the more it glows. The more Boris and Gleb glow, are transfigured by their closeness to Christ. What does this mean? What does it have to do with icons? It means that an icon is worthy of a kind of veneration that another picture might not be. It too participates in the Holy Presence. And this gets at the kind of sacramental quality of an icon. I think one way I understood this was the difference for me between this book, okay, which is the Bible, and, well, this book. This is a book of images that I'm going to refer to in a moment. This is one book, but this, you know, for me is the book. And somehow there's a kind of presence here. But let me try it another way. I might be getting out of my depth here, but an analogy might be the way in which a picture of a loved one has a kind of presence and is just not like any other picture. And to desecrate that picture in any way would just be a horrible thing. I happen to have a letter from my wife here, and there's a sense in which, you know, this piece of paper is different from other pieces of paper, right? Because there's something very important here to me. The crucial point that John is making, though, is that God does this work. God's grace transforms saints like Boris and Gleb, brings them closer to this fire, and when an icon has a holy image on it, it participates in the holiness which it images. One way of putting this, the honor due to the image passes to the prototype. That's another one of the arguments that John makes. Just as you would not tear up an 8th century Constantinople, a picture of the emperor, you would not desecrate an icon because somehow there's a presence there. And an honor that's due it in its image. So another way of looking at this is the story of what Orthodox believers is the first icon. King Akbar had left the city. He heard about Christ preaching. He wanted Christ to come visit him, presumably he healed him. Christ, who knew his passion this year, couldn't come, took a piece of linen, put it against his face, brought it back to King Akbar, and I believe the story goes that he's healed. Okay? Again, a kind of localization of the sacred. This is a holy piece, which becomes the prototype for later icons. Of course, Christ's face is the prototype, but then this becomes the source for future icons. Some of you have heard in the West of the Veronica story. Christ is on his way to being crucified. Veronica comes right, it's Christ's face, and there's the imprint of Christ's face on the wound. Just briefly, you'll see the way in which when the churches split in the 11th century, the Eastern and Western churches, the imaging of holy figures went their separate ways. This is still in the iconographic tradition. The elongated nose, the stillness of the figures, not as lifelike. Shimabue, 1200s, a little bit hints of departing from the iconic tradition, although still in it. Duccio as well. With Giotto, and I'm sorry about this very, very poor image. With Giotto, if you can see it, Mary certainly has a greater sense of volume as a body. Okay? Because of the idea of the transfigured flesh, does away with those passions which keep us from union with God. There is not as much emphasis upon the physical body. It's more stylized. Here you can see a body underneath Mary's clothes. Jesus looks a little bit more like a baby. In a couple of days, I'll be talking about St. Francis of Assisi as imaged by Dante, who's a contemporary of Giotto's. And what Francis did was embrace the natural world in such a way that imaginations like Giotto's and Dante's put a great emphasis upon the goodness of the body, okay, and reaffirmed that. Of course, Orthodoxy would do this as well, but in the iconographic tradition, there's this idea that the body is transfigured, and so less a sense of the natural body. And of course, with later artists like Botticelli, a Baroque artist like Gentileschi, which looks at one particular moment for the baby, now very much a baby, is reaching for the breast, a real departure from the iconographic tradition. Which Orthodoxy critiques and sees it falling away from what the icon does. When you're an icon painter, you efface yourself. You never sign your painting. You always work within a tradition. You say a prayer and you follow in the tradition of other icon painters. To do what these artists do is to show a kind of pride and not humbling oneself from tradition. How different Gentile Eshi's image is from this Vladimir Madonna from the 1100s, which is another one that I thought we could pause on for a few moments. This is one of the most famous Russian icons, and I'd like to hear what you see again. Let's take a moment and attend to this image, and maybe talk about what ways in which you would describe what you see.
It looks so loving.
Yes.
I mean, they're just caressing and care and concern and love for each other.
Yeah, tremendous tenderness. Others?
Looking at the eyes, the sort of the mouth, saying, I know what's going to happen to you.
Yeah, others have commented on this, that for all the tenderness, there is a sense in which Christ, in which Mary's face seems to show a kind of sorrow. I know what's going to happen, I know what's coming, a kind of melancholy.
What strikes me is the almost the reversal of the gender. That Jesus is so feminine there. He's a good masculinity.
But doesn't the Mary look so large, and yet the child looks old, but yet small?
Yes.
Like a miniature adult.
Yeah.
Baby.
Yeah.
That was the style of the age.
That's right. Yeah. They're following the iconographic tradition. In later years, after that 5th century encaustic icon, becomes less realistic, more stylized, okay, with this emphasis on transfigured humanity. What about gesture? You talked about hands with the Christ Pontifical. What do you see here? Did you notice anything about gestures?
The gestures? I'm having a hard time seeing it. Uh-huh.
I'm just going to close this for a moment to see if that'll help.
Yeah.
Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, a lot.
Okay, let's try that for a moment.
Yeah, is Mary got her hands in the sign of blessing?
Well, that's it. What about this hand? Is this a sign of blessing? What is this hand doing?
The bottom.
The bottom.
Yeah, that's okay.
It looks like
a
picture
sign.
Just like the claw. Yeah, it looks so different than the other. Is that really a hand?
It's like the hook.
It does. I'm sorry. Over here, that's what it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think maybe this is the damage of age. We're looking at another rendering of a much clearer one.
It kind of fallen away. That's why it's clear.
I'm wondering especially about the other hand, too. The hand that you can really see.
Casey? I see it being the tenderness also, but it's not holding on too tight. Mm-hmm. I think that there is still an openness that when the time is let go, it will
Can I say something about some of the symbols?
Yes, by all means.
Mary and this kind of a picture is the symbol of the church. As well, when the Orthodox talk about this one,
right?
It varies the symbol of the church, and at the same time, they speak of Mary as the kind of second. I'm going to say second incarnation, but what I mean by that is not that she is a second incarnation next to Jesus, but that she is the flesh out of which Jesus came on this flesh, and is a symbol for the whole of humanity in the church at the same time. So again, there's something deliberately paradoxical here. The baby is little,
and an adult at the same time.
Yes.
And Mary is taking care of him, but he's also clearly taking care of her.
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, it's the interpenetration of God in humanity through the incarnation. And again, the presence of the church in this, in the person of Mary.
In the person of Mary. Today at the forum, we're going to be talking about the church. And the way the church is described as the body of Christ, whose body is this? Well, here, as Roberta is laying out, the body of Mary as the church. But how does the church point to Christ? What is that hand doing? One might say that it is pointing to Christ, as the church ought to reaffirm Christ. But today, Paul mentioned Henri Nouwen. He has a book called Nouwen Hands, one of his early books. He also has a book called Praying with Icons. If you're interested in learning more about how one prays with images like this, and he writes about this image specifically. One hand supports the child, while another remains free in an open gesture of invitation. At first, I thought the Virgin pointed to Jesus with an open hand. I now realize that the word point misrepresents the true image of the gesture. She's not simply asking attention to the son, nor is she directing us to him. That would be too external, manipulative, controlling. I've slowly come to see the Virgin's gesture as a gentle invitation to move closer to Jesus and discover in that movement the God to whom we belong. Different kind of emphasis, which I find especially interesting in the light of Roberta's point about Mary as a kind of church, as an image of the church, and how we have a church that invites us to Christ. Jesus will experience his passion and death. Mary seems to foresee this, and this is an icon of the crucifixion, but I ask you again to notice the way the East and the West differ in their imaging of this event. Dionysus represents Christ in a kind of graceful way, so different from the brutal crucifixion, which emphasizes the agony of Christ's death, the pain of Christ's death, all kenosis. And the Orthodox Church would say, yes, then, but also the glory. Again, the transfigured flesh. The glory that comes with the crucifixion. So that even Good Friday would emphasize that in the liturgy. And you can see Mary off to our left, who's, again, in a sense, participating in Christ's suffering. Why is this honor due to Mary in particular? Because she participates and shares in the suffering of Christ, which leads to a notion very important in Orthodoxy and other Christian traditions, that of intercession, okay? That the saints intercede for us. On the other side of the handout that I gave you, you'll see the doors, an iconostasis that would appear in an Orthodox church, separating, in a sense, dividing the believers from the place where the priest transforms the bread and wine to the body and blood of Christ, where the Eucharist takes place. And it's through those doors that the sacrament of the Eucharist occurs. And what the iconostasis represents is the community of the church. Again, we have here another representation of the church. All those figures from Adam to Moses, if you look at 1A, from Adam to Moses, 1B, from Moses to Christ. And particularly in number 3, we have a number of saints who intercede and make prayers of the church for the world, okay, who intercede for us in the kingdom for our good. And this is an image of the royal door. And you see here the image of the Annunciation, the Eucharist, again, which the consecration takes place beyond the doors, and the four evangelists. imaging the gospel. And on an iconostasis like this, on the bottom row, on row four, if the church were, for example, St. Nicholas's church, then you might have an image of St. Nicholas. I include St. Nicholas, too, because he's one who writes about the importance of this event, that our salvation begins with Mary's utterance, "Be it done to me according to your word." Another important idea in Orthodoxy is this idea of sinner joy. It comes from St. Paul's letter to the Colossians, that we are fellow workers with Christ, that we cooperate. And the crucial event of cooperation is Mary's and God's. "You will bear a son. How can this be since I do not know man?" You get a little sense of that fear and that awe in Mary's posture, but also the deference of the angel. The crucial letter that you've done to me according to your word. Beginning Christ's life at that point. A closer image of Mary. Receiving the angel's words and uttering her own thoughts.
I don't understand what it's supposed to be.
Yes, it's a Greek word, synergoi.
Oh, it's Greek.
Sorry. Which means fellow worker. And in the letter to the Colossians, he uses that phrase. Another image of the Transfiguration, the iconostasis, we have images of feast days. And I'm going to move, I dare not move too quickly past this one. This is André Rublev's beautiful image of the three angels who come to visit Abraham, to whom Abraham shows hospitality. They prove to be angels, and in the Orthodox imagination, it becomes the image of the Trinity. Any observations about this image? Have you seen it before?
Yeah.
Some of you have? Some of it's beautiful? And I think this is important. The way the figures form a circle, beauty is a very important attribute in the Orthodox imagination. The Greek word philokalia, love of beauty.
The way the heads are bowed towards one another.
Yes.
You know?
There's especially a bowing here, yes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And usually this is thought to be the Father.
Father, yeah.
One of the ways in which the Eastern and Western churches are divided. We say the creed, the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. No, the Orthodox say proceeds from the Father. Okay, they want to keep that. And so there's a kind of deference toward the Father, one might say, in the bowing. But yet, one could also see it here as well.
Yeah.
Roberta, any insights into the Trinity that you see?
Well, one thing I would say is your insistence on the equality of the three members of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
One reason they would not want to say that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son is because they don't want it to be subordination. So the fact that his figures are the same size, relating to each other in the relationship with equality, again, is making a statement. It's also, I think, important to say that in the 20th century ecumenical work through the World Council of Churches, the Western churches are coming to say we made a mistake in adding that and the Son to the creed, and that the Orthodox is in fact more expressive of the tradition. And I think that's really interesting.
That is interesting.
Well, I was trying to look at those three heads, the way they're tilted, the way their faces go away. And I don't know how you could show equality differently than that. If you're looking for equality, that shows equality. Because they appear to venerate the one on the left, but the one on the left has a downcast
look
as well.
Yes, as well, as you said earlier. Yeah, no, I think that's really what you said. So again, the icon imaging this teaching here about the Trinity. and so the incarnation or the paradox is there. I really want to talk a little bit about images in your own lives, so I'm going to very quickly, this is the cover of the new play. Until 1904, this 15th century, 15th century icon was covered. And in other renderings of this scene, you can see the way the icon tradition, which is influenced by Rubens terrifically, also kind of falls away from some of the grace and the perfection of Rubens' work. More characters are added, Abraham and Sarah, endearingly, and the little boy and dog there, too. But by the 17th century, a very crowded icon, and not at all kind of beautiful image that we had in the empire. With the 20th century, an iconographic artist named Gregory Crewe comes along. He captures some of that Rublev quality, the luminous quality, the graceful quality. Again, much like the older Christ pontificator that we saw, the Madonna and Child calling back the Gladiator Madonna that we saw. And I close with this image, which is another image of theophany. It's Elijah listening, remember?
Oh.
And God is not in the wind, not in the earthquake, not in the fire, I believe.
Yeah.
He's in, well, listen, this is usually translated as breeze, but then I was reading the NRSV and I was so struck with this. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, the Lord was not in the fire. After the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" This notion again of attention, this notion that God comes in an unexpected way in silence. We live in cultures, we were talking about it yesterday, we're bombarded by information, technological distractions, other distractions. But to sit silently and wait, as Elijah does, and hear God in the silence, this icon suggests that in a very important way. I'm a little shy of doing this, but I'll do it anyway. A friend of mine, David Morgan, has said, this is an American icon. Warren Solve is Head of Christ. If you go to the library, you'll see it. That for many, and he has testimony from many, this is the kind of image which produces that kind of communion with the eternal that the Orthodox emphasize as being so important. Maybe I'll just pause for a moment and we can talk about your own experience with images and spiritual life. This one, icons or others, do you see them as a very important part of the spiritual life? Are they important in your own prayer life? And perhaps secondarily, this question of how do we discern when it is enriching our prayer life and when it's becoming more of an idol?
I think of it so much in terms of my life in the church as a child. And I think it was tremendously important to me then. I think there are so many concepts that are beyond an adult mind and beyond a child's mind. The idea of not having a physical presence, of not being able to picture a person,
yes,
a being in your mind. I think so much of, in the church I grew up in, there was a stained glass window of Christ as the Good Shepherd. That to me was what, in my mind when I prayed, that was the image I saw in my head. And it was real important to me. More so, I think, in the early years, but I think at that time it was that I needed to have one image. I think as one grows and sees so many different things, it's being able to see it in other images.
But when you were a child, that one image is going to be.
Right.
I was drawn to Catholicism as an adult, much because of all of the things that surround you in a mass, maybe the images on the wall, or the incense, or the candles, or the smells and taste. I mean, just all of those things to me I find so enriching, and I'm often so moved in a mass because of all the sensory things that are lacking.
Yes.
I think I'm having a nonsense stereotype. I grew up with the idea that these things were almost idealistic.
Yes.
It was wrong to spend money building these things that could be used for other people, you know, to help people or whatever, but trying to develop an appreciation for how they can be used as a tool of inner prayer. I think one of the negative things for Protestants too is that you only go up with this male icon. That one.
Yeah. And was this in fact the icon that you grew up with?
That was a picture in my church. Also the one of the shepherd with the lamb over the
field. Yes.
You're always male.
Yeah.
And when you have, I guess that's to me some of the richness of the Easter church.
Right. You mean with its emphasis on some a figure like Sophia, perhaps, you know, and Mary, where the field's over this
kind of like in your heart, you know, one version of the gospel, Mary's good and present at Jesus Christ. The baby's born. But I guess, like you say, for me, some couples think I was supposed to be kind of wrong when I was born in Jesus.
One of the distinctions John of Damascus makes is between veneration and worship. That an icon, because it images a holy figure, like Mary, like Christ, is worthy of my veneration and deep respect. But that's not the same as worship. I'm not bowing down and worshiping it. I know that it's only a portal, it's a window to God. But it isn't God. Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction. You heard it?
I think this question of the democratization of religion is really important, because I think we really, especially in the Protestant traditions, we really do this. You know, we don't like the idea that one person might claim to know more of God than another. And we don't even like the idea that one person might be claimed by others to know more of that God. And so we push that away, and we push away with that, and the idea of saints and Mary and Jesus. But one of the things, I think that we all have a hunger for people that we can look up to and say, this person knows Mary and me. And one place that I experience that is in a situation like this. I'm a teacher for a living. I'm always a teacher. You know, one of the things that is wonderful to me is to be able to be in a class where I'm being taught. You know, that's such a, I experience that as a spiritual gift, to have someone whose knowledge I can look up to and from whom I can learn. And that's such a profound need in me that I think is analogous to the need for to look at the images of Mary and the images of the saints and Christ as a human being and so forth, and be able to say, I don't have to represent the whole human race in my person, but the people who can learn from and lean on and can expect the prayers of. But we really, in this country, get caught in that. It's not just Protestantism, it's also American. The great American way. And I think a lot of us have been battered also in churches by people who put themselves forward as more holy than other people. And it's really a sort of self-righteousness rather than
you know, it doesn't have anything to do with the love of God. It has to do with keeping your enemies.
And I think that those saints, those teachers, you know, and I think this is what John of Damascus is saying too, grace is primary. This is God's work in us. That is, we're not holding ourselves up as authorities, as wonder workers, but rather we have been transformed by grace, transfigured by grace. Picking up on the Burger's point about America, this is a woman from Georgia, like Angela, program director, Flannery O'Connor, who is very much attuned to the way religion takes shape in America. And she writes this wonderful story about a man who loves images. In fact, he covers his body with tattoos. He likes any cobra, it could be an eagle, it could be Queen Elizabeth, that she happens to have right here. He marries a woman who's deeply religious. She's a woman who loves the word, who abides by the word. Her name is Sarah Ruth. He wants to please this woman. How can I please this woman? Well, if I get a picture of God on my back, one place where I don't have a tattoo, then I will please her. And he does. And this confrontation that takes place between the person and the word, God's presence is proclaimed in the word, God is transcended and can't be encompassed by wood or by place. And this kind of sacramental notion that somehow God can be present in images, for God was present among us as flesh, come together. And they don't come together in a nice, clear way. They come together in a complex way. That's what stories and poems are for. And what I'd like to do is invite you, if you can come tomorrow at 10:30, to take a copy of that story with you. If you do believe that you will come at 10:30, I brought 25 copies, I wanted to sure I have enough for everyone. I'll give you a copy right now. Read it, it's short, and come tomorrow and we'll talk about that story, especially what happens at the end. If you take one and you find you can't come, something comes up, just leave a copy right there and then the others who come in will have it and we'll be able to talk about it. But again, I want to thank you for your attention and your presence and for your good words. Thank you.
There's one thing I want to say. One thing. You spent a lot of time looking at the image.
Yes.
But there's something that's missing there, and that is the message from the artist. The reality of how the artist saw that picture the first time, put it together, and then as people copy it, the image gets degraded. It's kind of cloned, but it seems that there's something that comes from the artist that we need to, that draws us to the core.
It would be interesting to hear from icon painters. Mm-hmm. Again, there's this notion of self-effacing. I am mm-hmm. myself.
She does. I don't know who he or she is, but
right.
that person emptied themselves into that painting,
right.
And therefore we consider it beautiful or meaningful.
Yes.
The others are copies of that painting, and they are not as...
Well, in that group of example where I showed you the Nativity, the Trinity, you do see it there. Roberta.
So the artist wouldn't say that he or she empties himself or herself into the painting. They empty themselves away from the painting to make room for the Holy Spirit. It's not the person, the artist, the personality of the artist, but God working through that person who has set himself or herself aside.
You said what I said in different words.
Yeah. And to get testimony from some of those icon painters, with such testimonies, it's going to be very interesting. It might be in this book, which is in the library, Icons, Windows on Eternity, which I'll return to the library and it'll be available for you. But who would like a copy of Parker's Back by Flannery O'Connor? Okay. So let me just ask you to pass those around if you're wanting to read that for tomorrow. And